This second part of our morning is going to involve the people who can and do speak for EPA. We do have a panel substitution here. Nancy Grantham was unable to join us because of a canceled flight, but in her place is Mark McIntyre, Senior Public Affairs Specialist with EPA Region 10 over there in the lovely Pacific Northwest. Also on our panel is David Gray, the Director of the Office of Public Affairs at EPA Region 6 in Dallas. David, in addition to a long and distinguished career in public affairs, is also a former on-scene coordinator for the EPA, very relevant to what we're talking about today. And David will explain a little bit about what that means. We're going to look at what happens at the EPA when the first call comes in, and then how they gather the information, basically simultaneously as we are gathering the information. So we're going to see what we can do to clarify who does what and who says what. So, David, please take it away.
Test, test.
Great. Thank you very much. As Randy said, my name's David Gray. I'm the Public Affairs Director for EPA out of the Dallas office. And so just a little bit more about myself. I started at EPA in 1987, and so I've been there just a couple of years and still trying to learn my job on most days. But I did start with EPA as a federal on-scene coordinator. And so prior to coming to EPA, I was actually with a technical and scientific service contract for the agency. And primarily, I was responsible on a team that did first response work for EPA. And so I think most people know, or maybe don't know, but within the agency, most of the technical services assigned to emergency response are actually contracted out. They're held by national contracts in the United States, both on the emergency side as well as the long-term cleanup side, so we consider emergencies to be emergencies and removals, and we consider long-term cleanups to be remediations. And so we have two national contractors that run those, and so I used to work for one of those, which was a conglomerate of company Roy F. Weston, Jacobs Engineering, and Tetra Tech, which are some of the larger national first responding contracts. So I started my career working there and then came to the agency in 1987 predominantly to conduct a cleanup in Arkansas that some of you may have read about in the past. It was a facility called Vertac. It was a facility that was responsible for the production of Agent Orange in the United States. That went bankrupt in 1987 and abandoned their facility that was located in a residential area, leaving behind both a production facility as well as about 60,000 drums of Agent Orange waste that later had to be incinerated on site because the material did contain dioxin. It was prohibited by Department of Transportation of being transferred on the highways in the United States, and so it actually required to be removed there. But as well as we did residential cleanups along several waterways where we went in and removed soil from homes that were contaminated with dioxin. And it was 2,3,7,8, so one of the more toxic forms of dioxin. So that was kind of my introduction to the agency. Believe it or not, that site still continues, although much of the litigation on that site is completed. And then I've done a variety of other emergency responses. In 95, I moved to public affairs. And so I've been in the public affairs arena. So Randy thought that maybe it would be a good idea to talk a little bit about emergency response. And I brought a PowerPoint, but I'm not sure that we'll click through it much other than we will make it available to everybody on the SCJ website. But the a lot of folks may not know. So, Randy, if you click to the second slide, let's just look at this. So the beginning of a response. The agency primarily, we have a network called National Response Center, which actually for most federal agencies is the entry point for companies or individuals to alert the federal government of the need of a response. And EPA also uses this system as well as other agencies. But EPA also relies on this system. Under our statutes, companies are required to notify the agency of releases or potential releases of materials, whether or not it be chemicals or oil, and they are required to alert the federal government of that. And they do that through this mechanism. And so it's an 800 number that's run. It actually now is an electronic system that then notifies each of the response authorities of the potential for the need of an activation of response. And so it's a rather... it can be somewhat of a complicated system, but it is pretty automated now. And for much of the time, some of the data from this organization is actually available on the site. Although I do, it has a delay sequence to it. So if you're looking at the immediacy of information for a spill that you learn about in your community or that you know about, it may not be readily available from this website that's run by this organization, because it does take them some time to get that material there. But this at least is where the notifications began for the agency across the country. They call each of their prospective jurisdictions. So for Dallas, we represent five states. We have Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana. And so all of those calls would then come to us. We have an interesting jurisdictional issue in this part of the country because we have coastal, so we share jurisdictions with the U.S. Coast Guard. And so there are many cases where this notification will come both to EPA as well as the Coast Guard so that a jurisdictional call can be made about who is the lead response agency. So just a little bit on that. If we go to the next slide... this is just some interesting trends that our folks pulled together. This looks pretty erratic, but generally saying in the United States we have about 20,000 calls a year. That's a pretty standard number that could be used. It jumps around, but there's about 20,000 calls that come into the response center every year. Again, these are predominantly from industry themselves, from responsible parties because it's required by the statutes. Although there are some volumes in some other slides that are in this presentation can actually show you some breakouts of where those calls come from, as well as, surprisingly or not, there are still some responses that we respond to in which the company does not call, which is a failure to notify, which actually triggers them into an enforcement side of our response network. And so there are some slides in this presentation that can also show you some details on the numbers of responses that happen where the company does a fail to notify, and which we take very seriously at the agency. On the next slide that I'll show you, this might give you an indication of maybe why Randy asked me to come up and speak about it. About 33% of the responses in the United States happen in Region 6. Not particularly something we're terribly... proud of, but a factor that is relevant. We have a large industrial corridor. I think, as folks know, many of you are seeing it or going to see it tomorrow on some of the tours. But we have a large industrial corridor that runs from all the way from Baton Rouge down into the Gulf Coast of Texas, and so we have a very dense industry sector, industry belt in this part of the country that makes up for some of that. Also, I think as most folks know, probably on any given day about 61 to 66% of the oil and gas production in the United States comes from this region. So we do a fair amount of oil and gas response work also in all of our states, including Oklahoma, Texas, and Louisiana are pretty high on the list there. So from the notification of a response that comes into our 24-hour hotline, there's typically a judgment call that is made in following up with both the local entity, which is typically the police and fire, which are typical first responders. And I think folks know, Mark and I were just speaking on this just a moment ago, I think folks know that particularly with the formation of Department of Homeland Security and the resources that came to DHS, there's been a lot more people and equipment that have been deployed into local LEPCs and local responders. And so we see a lot more, I think, response from local jurisdictions than we did in the past. So we have, I think, readily over the last few years seen some decline in EPA's forward-leaning response because local capacity has increased. And so we do have a lot more local jurisdictions responding and the agency not being needed to respond. But should the local entity and the industry involved be not capable of responding or not capable of fully responding, the elevation process is then for the state to respond. So this, every state in the United States has a response network, much like the agency does, and they have certain capacities there, and they will respond. And then when they reach their capacity limitations or scientific limitations, they will ask the agency to respond. So it's always deflected to the local jurisdiction first, and then there's an elevation process for response. And it's based on a request. It is a request sequence. Although, as everyone knows, there is a federal authority to intervene on behalf of communities and to respond. And so primarily what we're seeing in the last, I would say, 10 years or so is the agency playing more of a technical assistance role. And this derives primarily from the access to resources. I think folks know that we have some fairly sophisticated instrumentation. We have mobile triple mass specs, which we call TAGAs, but we have mobile air units that are able to measure a very substantial and very small amounts of pollution. We also have radiological abilities to look at radiological materials fairly quickly. And we have a scientific aircraft called ASPECT, which is also something that we deploy primarily to survey large air emissions, so explosions and fires. We will send the ASPECT aircraft, and it can fly through plumes and collect data, but as well as it can do on-ground surveillance. And so we deploy ASPECT for also large gatherings, whether or not it's the Super Bowl or other national events. We will pre-deploy and fly during those events a piece of equipment that we have that it can also monitor for radioactive materials as well as the dirty bombs. And so we deploy those assets also. But primarily in the last, most recent generation of response, EPA is deployed in providing those types of kind of technical supports, allowing the state or local jurisdiction to remain the lead, but as well as then deploying assets to be particularly helpful to those agencies. Something that is that comes out of that that continues to be a challenge is data and scientific data. When we collect data, we have typically continued to try to push that data out through our own mechanisms rather than providing that data like you might to, as a contractor to some other organization. But data continues to be an interesting dilemma. And then the next level of trigger is, of course, the federal response. This would be which are, many of you are very significantly familiar with. This would be things like being a portion of the BP spill. This would be Katrina. This would be the Oklahoma City bombing. It would be the space shuttle. This would be the Los Alamos fires. And those types of incidents, the agency is also activated, but it's activated under a different scenario where the federal, where the incident is federalized and the agency has a jurisdictional role. And so you'll hear about ESFs, designated mission assignments for different agencies, whether or not you be Department of Agriculture, Department of Commerce, or the agency. And under that scenario, the agency is mobilized to oversee and manage hazardous waste. And so in Katrina and other instances, you'll see us involved in things like the collection of household hazardous waste, the assessment of wastewater treatment plants or drinking water treatment plants, or the remobilizing of facilities, bringing the facilities back online, as well as the containment response to hazardous and oil. And so that, just in sweeping terms, gives you a broad sense of kind of our response. Mark, maybe I'll ask you if you have anything to add to that.
Sure.
I would have first.
Mark is this little yellow triangle on there and the number of responses.
It's a very enthusiastic triangle.
It is.
Absolutely.
Yeah, my name is Mark McIntyre. I've been coming to SCJ since 2001 and have loved them. And it's just been it's an extraordinary experience to be here today and to be with you all. I don't have a super robust presentation because I only learned about 45 minutes ago that I was going to be sitting here. But what I will say is I work at sort of in the hierarchy of EPA. I work sort of a level below David. So I report to somebody like David in my region, in Region 10. So as a result, I've been doing that since 1992. I started there in 1992 and prior to that, worked for the state of Washington, the Department of Ecology, doing similar kind of response work. But I tend to be the kind of person who they fly out in the middle of the night to go into Joint Information Centers, or JICs, and help kind of make them go and make them run. So I am a person who tends to work with reporters a lot every day, especially during emergencies. And so it's kind of a rarefied world, the JIC world, and it has its own challenges and its own opportunities. A lot of times I find when I get to Joint Information Centers where there's a responsible party or somebody who had a problem, a company, and the state, sometimes they aren't always getting along that well when I get there. So that adds another kind of interesting layer of trying to help kind of, you know, pull that rift together before we kind of can move forward and get information out in a really sort of cohesive way about the event. So I would love to answer your questions. I don't have a lot more to say. I have been at several national Kalamazoo River in Michigan. I don't know if people were there. I worked there. I worked at Katrina. I was here in November for Katrina, and worked on a couple of. I work more in this kind of secondary tier. There's a lot of tier ones, the pipelines, things like that. But I tend to work a lot more in the secondary level. But I feel good about what I've done in trying to get information out to reporters and the public, and would be happy to answer any questions you might have about how we can do that better.
Thank you, Mark. Before we go to discussion and questions, I want to show you a few interesting photographs, if I can make this go away. One moment, please.
Talk among yourselves while I do this.
Okay. One moment.
The pictures are going to be great. You're going to love them.
So maybe
somebody ask a question.
Yeah, actually, so maybe while Randy does that. So Randy, when he called me and said, what are some pointers or things that you would think about that might be helpful to reporters who are you know, coming to a response and trying to garner information? And I think that some things that I would mention that I see routinely at responses, or questions that I see that we get routinely at responses, that I would probably put on your short list of kind of quick first things to start inquiring about. The first one is about what is the organization of the response, kind of who is in charge. Because I think that there's a jump to an assessment that because the agency's there, or because an agency's there, it's a federal agency, that it has assumed the lead. And in reality, that's not always true. And so I would encourage you to become familiar very quickly with the incident specific structure, because I've been around a little while, and it is different at every single one I've ever been to. And so I would just put that on your first kind of quick things to ask when you talk to a PIO at a site, or a responder at a site, is kind of, okay, what's the organizational structure for this response? Because I think that can help guide, I think that helps to guide your questioning. And I say that because I think it also helps to expedite your questioning. Because I do sometimes worry that questions get lost in this endless to-do loop because they're not presented quickly to the responsible agency. And so that's something I would mention. The next is that I would mention is data, scientific data. And that's to clearly ask the question, scientists have a dictionary of their own, and very quickly understand the difference between monitoring data and sampling. Because they are uniquely different, and you will get very different answers from a responsible agency based on your sophistication of asking the question about monitoring data versus sampling data. And so the more you can understand that, the better. And so in most instances, I would say monitoring data happens first. And the difference that I would say quickly for you in monitoring data versus sampling data, monitoring data is typically drawn to understand for situational awareness. It's typically drawn to understand health and safety concerns associated with the first responders. It's useful information for the community, but it's generally drawn to understand amongst the responders what type of precautionary measures need to be taken. And so in almost every scenario, monitoring data will be collected very quickly. It's generally very rough information, and it's generally taken to guide internal decisions about responders. And so that's monitoring data. Sampling data, of course, comes later. It is typically more scientifically rigorous. And the thing that I would guide you on sampling data is, unfortunately, it takes time. And so it's the one that no one loves, because it's the one that can take, I would say from 48 hours at the fast end to 10 days at the other end. And that's just dependent on what type of data it is, what type of analytics have to be done, and what type of quality assurance has to be done. And so I would encourage you, when you hear that the response has shifted from monitoring data to sampling data, to ask the question very quickly about what sampling data is done and what timeline does that follow. Because even where someone can't give you the answer to what it says because they don't know, they should be able to give you very quickly the timeline for when that data will be becoming available, what that process is, because those analytical procedures are pretty standardized, those quality assurance procedures are pretty standardized, and if anything, you should get it kind of faster than that standardization versus slower. but you should be able to get very quickly. So understanding monitoring data and then asking questions about what sampling is being done and what is the process for that will help you fill that void of wanting to know the answer of it. Because frankly, the thing that we discovered in the agency is the one thing you won't be able to rush is data. The scientists, the rigor of the science that goes with that data, the importance of that data, because the sampling data is then used for public health and other decisions. And so it guides, or for cleanup decisions. And so it guides action and public health decisions. And so it undergoes a significantly stronger amount of rigor and importance is placed on it. And then the final thing that I always see happen, not always, but I routinely see happen at a response, it gets into a discussion that the previous panel had about lawyers, is whose fault is it? And questions about responsibility. And the thing that I will tell you in today's world that everyone has realized is you're not going to get an answer to that. The people who are responding are not the people in the agency who enforce. We have a separate department that does. They are not the individuals that investigate and enforce. And so the people who are responding are focused on response and cleanup. It's a separate arm of the agency that's going to then invoke guilt and responsibility and violation of the federal statutes. And that is a deliberative process that's going to take time. And as most of you know, if you follow cases, many times it's months after a response is concluded that the agency bring forth court-driven actions. And that's just the necessity of the quality of those actions. We like to win. We really don't like for federal court or federal judges to overturn our actions or to not have the what we call responsible parties reimburse us for cost. And so so that branch of our agency is very rigorously and is also a due process. And so until that case is ready to be filed and lodged, there's really not a lot of transparency in it. That said, we do have this fairly good, although not great, online mechanism called Echo, which allows you to look at a company's enforcement record. So there is an online system. It contains both EPA and state data that allows you very quickly, though, to go online and evaluate the enforcement history of a suspected facility. And so it's a very useful tool. Again, I would encourage you, you always have to stand back and not speculate on who's at fault or what the cause is. But it will at least allow you some immediate insight into a company's compliance and enforcement history, as well as if they're under any current type scrutiny. And I know many times with reporters, that type of interest is important to the public that you serve. And so that is a database that's online, and so it's 24/7, easily available and pretty searchable. The other thing that database now does, I believe starting this last year, is it offers comparisons. So it does offer state-by-state comparisons for facilities. So I mentioned that.
Good. Thank you, David. Did you have anything you wanted to add to that? Okay. All right. I'd like to show you just a few images of a real-life emergency response that the EPA was very deeply involved in, along with quite a number of other federal and state and local agencies. The evening of April 17, 2013 was really a lovely, quiet evening in West Texas. That's West, Texas, not West Texas. West is south of Dallas, north of Waco. It's a small community, a farming community, also commuters into Waco every day. You obviously see the Sonic here. The little brown building with a little fellow on it on the right-hand side is the check stop. That's C-Z-E-C-H, because West is primarily settled by people of Czech descent. So you'll see lots and lots of Czech names in the phone book. At about 7:30 or so p.m., people in the parking lot of the Czech stop stopped and looked up at this cloud that was rising just beyond the Sonic. You'll see someone in the bottom of the picture there staring up at the cloud. Here's what that cloud looked like a little while later from a little further away. This was the biggest thing that ever happened in West, as you could imagine. Here's a before picture. In the upper left, you will see the buildings with the white roof. That's an elementary school. A little bit further toward the top of the picture, you will see an apartment building. Just beyond that, at the very top of the picture, is a nursing home. And in the lower part of the picture is West Fertilizer Company. The little tiny white tanks held next to the central building held anhydrous ammonia as a fertilizer. The gray building to the right of those tanks held a very large volume of ammonium nitrate fertilizer. Here's the after picture. You'll see that the school was basically destroyed. The force of the blast, you can see the center of the crater where the ammonium nitrate building was. The force of the blast lifted the roof of the elementary school and slammed it back down. It's a very common scenario in these kinds of things. You'll see that the line of apartment buildings just above the middle of the picture, above the circle, which was a track area for the high school, you'll see that the apartments are destroyed. And beyond that, the nursing home took significant damage. Here's a close-up of the apartment complex. Obviously, this was a major disaster. Some Texas state officials described it as an unfortunate accident. Covering this story, it didn't take me long to declare this a 100% preventable mishap. At every step of the way, from land use planning to simple fire and explosion safety, to the LEPC process, everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. The toll was this, 15 people killed. Those were, except for one person, those were first responders, volunteer firefighters who went to fight a fire. The fire broke out before the explosion. What eventually was found to have happened was that the fire caused the roof to collapse. The fire is of unknown origin, by the way. The ATF came up with a couple of possible scenarios. It could have been an electrical problem, or it could have been electrical wiring problem, or it could have been a short circuit in or some kind of problem with a golf cart. A golf cart may have caused this. The firefighters were mostly surrounding the fertilizer building at the time it when it exploded. Should they have been there fighting the fire? Probably not. But because in other cases we've seen evacuations done in lieu of trying to fight a fire like this. However, they did give their lives trying to evacuate, or some were evacuating. Some were trying to fight the fire, and eventually they were all killed. West, like many, it's like the vast majority of communities in Texas, has only a volunteer fire department, has no professionals, receives some training and equipment money from the state, but it's very inadequate. So one of the things I would advise everyone to do is get roughly familiar with the state of firefighting in your community and in your greater in your state. How many of these folks are volunteers? How many of them have any kind of professional on their staff? What kind of support does your state provide for training and equipment? The other thing I would say is that this could have been prevented with the proper amount of planning. I will put my newspaper, the Dallas Morning News, along with everybody else who didn't do their job here. If we had known about this, if we had known there was a facility like this before the evening of April 17, 2013, we might have reported on it. We might have said, there's a dangerous situation here. The locals all would have said, oh, you're crazy, everything's fine. I know old Charlie runs the plant. He's fine. He's one of us. And that's all fine and good. But there's a point at which we have to take that responsibility. And frankly, after this happened, we went out and found every other ammonium nitrate facility in Texas and did something of a fire and explosion safety review of those. But we didn't do it in advance. So that's something that we really feel that we could have done better as well. The only other thing I want to add about this is that there were some really, really erroneous reports going on about this. The first was that because the facility had anhydrous ammonia, it was probably the anhydrous ammonia that exploded. Well, it's nearly impossible to explode this stuff. There is a physical response that can cause an explosion, but it's not a fire hazard like this. So it was clear from the beginning that that was incorrect. So within an hour or two of the thing, I was saying, no, it's probably ammonium nitrate. We also had reports that a rail car had exploded. Someone decided, even the chairman of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality repeated that in a talk he gave. Well, he was simply flat wrong. The ammonium nitrate was inside the building. As your editors are saying, are we following the rail car scenario? I was saying, no, because that's stupid. I'm not doing that because I know it's not true. As a matter of fact, in the aerials, you could see the rail car on its side with its ammonium nitrate spilled out and not blown up. At any rate, you will find a lot of crummy information flying around. You'll find your editors grabbing onto the worst of that and saying, why aren't we doing this? And you just simply have to say, because we know better. One of the earlier panel, I think it was Wilma, mentioned the RTKNet. RTKNet, one of the things they do is they'll put the majority of the information from risk management plans online. The EPA cannot do this because of security concerns, but it's still public information. So they go through the trouble of doing this. By going to their site, I knew immediately that they had reported anhydrous ammonia within an hour of the blast. I was reporting this online. It was obvious that that wasn't the explosion source. But what was the only interesting part of their risk management plan was that they had checked the boxes that they were supposed to check. And because the RMP deals only with the anhydrous ammonia, because the EPA has not placed ammonium nitrate on the list of reportable chemicals for that purpose, the company was able to say, no risk of fire or explosion, check, because there is none from anhydrous ammonia. So I was able to say immediately that this thing that just blew up and killed a bunch of people was officially reported by the company as having no risk of doing this. So this is how misleading the information can be. So the point of my story at that point is the system, they did what they were required to do in terms of reporting, but the reporting requirements are inadequate, so that's important for the public to keep in mind. Throughout this, we found that some official sources, not so much federal, but some state sources, were really being quite unreliable. And so we had to bring in our own expertise, our own experience, and really be a quality control check on much of what they were saying. And that's an important role for us to do as well. We cannot just simply be receivers of information. Frequently, we have to be the generators of it. Okay, I'm now going to open it up to questions, and no holds barred. So just go at them.
Well, I thought you wanted to do some specifics.
Okay, I'm good. All right, who's got a question? Jim. Jim Brugger.
This is a question for Randy and also the EPA folks. So this National Response Center data, I have never actually tried to get that data, try to see what it says, try to figure out how many spills are reported for my community and that sort of thing. What kind of stories can be generated from that? How do you get access to it? Is it just through a FOIA? Do you have a good website access?
So initially, I would say it's a website. You can get website access. I think that, I'll just say, I'm not a huge fan of FOIAs, and what we encourage, at least in Region 6, is for us not to have journalists have to do a FOIA, for us to gather information and get it to reporters. That said, we still do get FOIAs from reporters, but it's always been my preference to work through the office and just have us get it for you, because we have folks like who did this PowerPoint for me, Steve Mason, who has access to it, can download it in Excel spreadsheets and get it to us in a couple of days. And so I would encourage you to look at the website, and if you feel like it has some searchability limitations that might not let you hone into the exact perspective, although I believe, if I recall correctly, it's searchable by zip code. And it does include historical data, that you do that. But if not, I would go to your local regional office first and ask them if they would be able to assist you in getting it through one of their folks that works with the data system. And then certainly a FOIA is a way to do it. But again, I don't know what your feeling is about FOIAs. I don't find them to be very quick or very great, but that's my own perspective of them. But it is a searchable database.
Well, David, I might add, unless you're a federal state employee with access, I don't think it's a public website. And the reason is because to get the type of information like Steve Mason put together for you, because within those files, within each of those entries, there's data that because of company protection on personal information restricts some of that access. So it's best to work through.
Yeah. The NRC does have a publicly available website that reports all the calls that come in.
Right.
By location, by what was spilled, amount believed to be spilled, did it reach water or not. But the best use for that is really as a very gross level screening tool. It's my equivalent for it is it's a list of 911 calls, not a list of detectives' findings.
Okay. I was more talking about the one that has some of the other information. The other thing is a lot of the information that initially comes in that is never changed, early information is often wrong. And it was a good point about which the chemicals are.
Self-reporting.
Yeah. I would add that during the investigation of West, our data team looked at a number of federal databases on incident reporting like this. And what they found was that in the sample that they used, about 80% of the information eventually turned out to be wrong.
Exactly.
So it's very much a grain of salt kind of thing.
I was supposed to add my name, Charlie Henry. Sorry.
Thanks, Charlie. Hi, my name's Stephanie, so I'm an energy reporter based out of Washington. I had a question about the ECHO database, because it's come a long way. It's much better, I have to say, than the last couple years, because it's combining TRI data, all different databases. I just wanted to see if, David, if you could talk about what limitations you see with the ECHO data in terms of how often it's updated. And I've looked up certain facilities in there, and it just shows if there are violations, which means if there is no high-priority violation or significant, it doesn't mean that the facility is necessarily clean. It just means that it hasn't reported a violation in the last couple of years. So I just wanted to see if you had advice on how to interpret it and then talk about some of the limitations. Thank you.
Yeah, so I will absolutely agree. This last round of improvements to ECHO, I think were great improvements, but it is not there yet. I mean, I just would not guide anyone to that it's the end-all answer. It is a place to get some information about compliance enforcement history on facilities very quickly, in a more succinct way, because as everyone knows, before that, the agency ran some 10 or 11 different data systems, depending what statute we were looking at a facility under, that didn't talk to each other and that didn't have public access. And so this is the agency's attempt to automate that and to improve it. But it is not the end all of the world. For example, in Region 6, one of the things that we launched last year was we launched our own supplemental data system, where we put a copy of all of our inspection reports and all of our enforcement actions, including administrative actions, on a searchable database on our own website. And one of the things I know that they're looking at in ECHO is connecting to those PDF files of actual inspections and enforcement actions and making those available so that the next generation of ECHO will actually get you a little deeper visibility into those. And we are also now including infrared. We collect infrared camera images many times when we do inspections, where you can see emissions from tanks or other emissions. We're also including some of those, the things that support the inspection enforcement action. And that's something I know that Cynthia Giles from D.C., our head of enforcement, is looking at as a next round of enhancement, because it has been easily done. We're looking at automating our information anyways. We're moving to e-filing systems. And so as we move from a paper kind of into a paperless system, it also makes a lot of that information just much more easy for us to connect to data systems. And so I think that you're going to see ECHO continue to grow because it's been popular, but I agree with you that I wouldn't want to overstate that it's perfect. It is, however, in my history at the agency, the first time that you could actually see into these multiple data systems and have it drawn for you. And as far as interpretation, again, I would just always encourage you to call one of us because I agree with you that many times I will need to put an inspector or an enforcement agent on a closed case on the phone just to walk through some of the nuances of a collective data set for a facility where, if you're not careful, it could imply great compliance, which may not be reality. So I would always second check that question, that conclusion, I guess, is it would be my recommendation. I don't know if that's helpful.
And that was David, for those of you listening online, David from the EPA.
Hi, my name is Jonathan Henderson. I'm with the Gulf Restoration Network. And I'm actually somebody that uses the National Response Center pretty frequently. I manage our field operations in the Gulf, and I'm out quite a bit on boats and planes looking for leaks and spills. And I've filed probably 100 at least reports for different leaks and spills with the National Response Center. A couple of things. First of all, the National Response Center website is not working right now. It's been down since February. Early on, we were told that it was down because they were going to do some maintenance to it and do some enhancements. About 6 months later, I got an email from the chief of the National Response Center saying that they had been compromised and they were hacked. So, and that anybody, any user that had ever filed a report needs to be looking out for their personal information to make sure that there are no strange things going on with your information. But aside from that being an embarrassment, that Homeland Security's national reporting system was hacked, it's still down. But I wanted to say that one of the benefits that it's provided for us, it's a limited amount of benefits provided for us. In addition to filing the report, one of my allies, SkyTruth, scrapes all the NRC reports for this region. So I was able, when the website was still available, to get an email every day with every single NRC report that was filed in this area. And so I could look at that report and, yes, take the information with a grain of salt, because a lot of the reporting is done by the companies themselves, and it behooves them to underreport. There's a lot of underreporting, for instance, that happens. But I could still look and figure out geographically where this leak was located and decide if I want to go out and look at it myself and do our own investigation. But in terms of transparency, the last bit of information after I file a report that I receive, I get an email confirmation from Homeland Security saying that they got my report. But the last information is which parties were notified. Okay? There's a web report, and all it says is that these different agencies were notified. Boom, end of transparency. So from that point on, I have no idea if Coast Guard launched a helicopter to go and fly over it. I have no idea if they found the leak. I have nothing. There's nothing there. So I'm wondering if that's part of these planned enhancements, if there's going to be more information available for folks like myself, which, by the way, I'm doing the guiding the flyovers on Sunday with Southwings. If anybody's interested, you can talk to me.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. And I don't know if it's a part of the NRC enhancement, but we are able to tell you if we responded. And the thing that I haven't ever thought about till you just said this statement was not realizing that there were audiences that it would benefit if that was automated. So instead of having to call the agency and saying, have you sent a team to XYZ, because we have internal notification, clearly. I get notified every time we respond. We're responding now. I would get a BlackBerry message telling me that we deployed the team and what the assets were, you know, and what was going on. And so, but what I had never thought about was the benefit of automating that, so that in this transparent world, that of folks who are monitoring, whether it's other community organizations or community themselves or reporters, that they could just go to an online system and say, oh, today EPA Region 6 is responding here. Here's the five places, or Seattle's responding, or because we clearly know that, and we clearly communicate electronically, but I had not thought about the benefit of that. But I would say that that's a great takeaway and something that I would personally be interested in looking into.
Okay, and again, that was David.
And that was David Gray, sorry. I forget that there's this other audience someplace.
And we're going to take one more question, then I'm going to ask the other panelists to come up and sit up there in case they have additional input. All right.
Hi, Robin Bravender from Greenwire. Thanks for doing this. I wonder if both of you can just explain briefly sort of the everyday responses from the agency when reporters' inquiries come in. When do you have to go up the totem pole to get responses? When can you put scientists on the phone with reporters? When do you have to run your responses by headquarters, et cetera? Just brief us on how that all works.
And so are we in the emergency response world or
I'm
just general?
About generally.
So I would say, much like many of the agencies spoke before, you know, clearly our goal is to have scientific experts talk about their work. I mean, I think that that's important. I think that we all take that as important. Mark and I were actually talking about this as we came in the room because of some questions that came to the earlier panel, which I think is the challenge of policy issues. And I think that for us, so clearly all of our folks talk about their work and talk about their activities, but it's the when it gets into the where the agency is going, kind of the policy perspective. And that's clearly not what we do in the regions. The that audience of folks and decision makers sat in the Beltway for us in Washington, D.C. And I think the part that we struggle with, if I could say, the most is when those are closely woven together. And so what we try to do is we try to answer and talk to put our scientific experts on the topic at large that up to the point of implementation. And then deflect the policy questions to Washington where it's more appropriate for them to put the policy decision maker on. And I think that's pretty consistent for us. Is that the same for you?
Yeah, I think for us, for me personally, when I am either involved in an incident or something happens, one of the keys to survival, I think, in an emergency response is situational awareness. And that's just knowing what's going on. And it's the thing that I struggle with the most in trying to make sure I'm clear on who else needs to know about what's happening in an almost real-time way. And that becomes one of my biggest challenges, is making sure that the right people... I kind of over-function in terms of letting people know, because I know that... there's always someone somewhere else above the person I'm sending this to who will inevitably ask them, do you know what's going on up in Prudhoe Bay? And that if that person goes, huh? That's a really bad place for them. So I try to make sure that they know. So it's just notification. This is Mark McIntyre at EPA.
And I would add one other thing. In Region 6, at least, we have a long-standing strategy that particularly our OSCs and our remedial response managers talk to the press, that they are empowered to talk to the press, that we want them talking to the press. They play an important role about situational awareness about what's going on in communities. Again, I think that the thing that I hear from them and the struggle that they have is when a situational assessment gets into a broader perspective, and they're uncomfortable with that. But I think that it's always important for us to have that information out there. And I think we struggle to do a pretty good job of it. But there are certainly issues or questions. I think I heard it in the earlier panel about transparency and the ability of folks to get the information that they're looking for. David Gray.
So we're going to ask Charlie, Ken, Mark, and Wilma to come on up. And just a reminder that Mark from Entergy is leaving at 11:15. So if you've got a nuclear question, you want to get that in early. And then Charlie and I don't know, David, you guys are going to stay here. The EPA is staying here. To talk just really quickly also about JICS so that people understand that it's a formalized process and they're present at every big disaster, and it's what we work through. So,
can I add one quick thing in response to Jim Brooker's question about the use of the NRC information? Assuming that it's working and Anonymous has done, or whoever it was, has done their deed and moved on. A few years ago, the state of Texas was coming up with a new plan to control PCBs going into the Trinity River, which is a dull little poor maligned stream that goes through downtown Dallas. There's not much you can do about PCBs in reality, but I used that as a jumping off place, and I used NRC reports going back a number of years to map every report of a PCB spill. 99% of them are from electrical transformers that haven't been converted yet. But I was able to make a map and publish it of every PCB spill in the downtown Dallas area over the last 30 years or so, or however long the data went back. So that I found was very useful. I didn't have to find out all the investigative things that went after that, but I could simply mark the initial reports. So I think that was something that was helpful to the public.
Okay. It's Charlie Henry.
No, Nancy asked if I could give a little bit of insight to the JIC, kind of my perspective being someone inside the command post. And I've probably been in, I don't know, far more than 100, probably less than 300 command posts over the last 20 years. But part of it's driven, I just want to give you kind of an insider look.
Oh, hey, Charlie, real quick, I'm sorry. Tell them what JIC stands for.
I'm sorry. JIC is the Joint Information Center. And I'm going to back up even further. Dave hit it really well when Dave said that not every incident command or who's in charge is the same. I mean, he's right on. It does kind of follow some normal sequence. For example, if it's an oil spill and it's under Open 90 authorities and it's in the coastal zone, it's going to follow a similar formula. But a chemical spill inland may be totally different. So it does. There's a lot of variability that exists. So Dave is right on trying to figure it out. But what happens is, on what we're mandated to do as federal government, and this started a long time ago, is the federal government manages these incidents under what's called NIMS ICS, and that's the National Institute of, National Incident Management System, Incident Command System. And this grew out of confusion from years and years ago, much like the incident in West, where they'd have a big event, you'd bring in responders from different counties and different locations, and actually started with the forest land wildfires, but you'd bring in people from different states and different counties and put them under a system where they were supposed to be working together, and found out there was miscommunications, there was lots of coordination problems, and people were actually put in bad positions and actually died during fighting forest fires. So what evolved was a system of really managing the response, and that's what's called ICS. In an oil spill, we kind of think about it as putting a company together in the middle of the night to respond to an event, because you have groups, whether it's it's industry who has the responsibility to respond under their contingency plan, whether it's the federal government that has oversight roles from a variety of different perspectives, or it's the state that has also an oversight role and it's also their residents and their people. All these people come together in the middle of the night, and sometime before, within 4 hours, 6 hours, 24 hours, you want to form a company that's going to be running effectively and efficiently. Deepwater Horizon is an example. That company grew as high as 52,000 employees at one point. Those are people working under a coordinated system called the Incident Command System. But even smaller events, like this, the response in West, would have benefited probably from more coordination early on, most likely. So it failed from that perspective. But part of that is you have the incident commanders, and because they're shared joint responsibility. It's a unified command. This is where the JIC part gets in, unified command. So it might be the Coast Guard, might be the state of Texas, might be Texas Commission on Water Quality, like in the post-incident with the explosion in West, and the responsible party to make up the unified command. That's the three primary groups that came together to form this company in the middle of the night. You'd have the operations section, planning section, logistics, finance section, and various other little groups tagged onto it. One of them tagged onto it is the Joint Information Center. And the purpose of the Joint Information Center, it's part of this corporation that was built in the middle of the night called the Incident Command Center, or part of the Unified Command. It tries to have a common message that reflects what the incident command is doing, what the issues are that have been agreed upon by the incident command, what actions are taking, a lot of the facts and figures, and also to provide access to members of the unified command to ask and to answer specific questions, often during several different media opportunities during the day, but side issues as well with direct interaction. So it really is not representing, for example, the Coast Guard. It's representing the unified command. And part of that is you don't see in the background what they'll present. They want to have a very common view. This is what's been agreed upon because that's what's gone into action plans, reflecting that unified company. It doesn't reflect necessarily the fighting that goes on in the background and pushing and shoving to get to an agreement. When they step forward, they're stepping forward unified because they're part of a unified response. And that's something you have to, it's a subtle thing that you have to see. It doesn't mean that when the cameras aren't off, it's like, but when they're there as the unified command, which is mandated by a presidential directive, they work as a group. And so keep that in mind, that the JIC is part of a functional group of the Unified Command, which is how we're managing the response. It's got limitations. It's not perfect, but it's that part of that fictitious company that was put together. And so know that it's representing that part of the response. I don't know if that helps at all. But, yeah.
Charlie, could you also talk about IRMA? This is Ben Sherman.
Okay. It's Charlie Henry again. IRMA is, you know, is a NOAA product, so we're promoting a NOAA product. But IRMA, you know, and what the acronym means, I've long since forgot, but it's not important. What it is, we use it during emergency response, and it's commonly used by the Coast Guard as a common operating picture. Basically, it's a way to create that situational awareness information, so information from a lot of different sources could be put in a common GIS-type environment, so we can view a lot of information, not just as layers, but together, and look at trends, look at issues, look at problems. And for the Deepwater Horizon oil spills, an example, there was a public viewing site of that there was a huge amount of information that was on. So it's one that we would like to even have more reflective on the public side. It just takes a lot of effort. So sometimes the public side lags just because of the work to get it in the system. And it all goes into responders can deal with a little bit of uncertainty because we're used to uncertainty. When you make it publicly facing, we don't want that uncertainty in there. We want it to be fairly reflective of what we think is real. So there's a little more QAQC goes into it. Thank you.
Additional questions?
I'm Brian Norcross from the Weather Channel. I wanted to go back to something that Kim and Graham said earlier, and he and I were chatting about this after, because I just think it would be interesting for this audience. And I've come listening to all this talk about oil spills and these kinds of incidents, realize how different that is from these weather emergency things that we deal with. But a key issue in the weather world is that there's nobody that everybody believes anymore, which is what Ken's point was. And so, therefore, it's very, very difficult to manage an emergency because you're trying to manage the public. In this case, this whole discussion is really pretty easy, because you're trying to really manage getting information to skilled people, where in the weather issues, which can be obviously quite dynamic and important, the people that are receiving information very often are not skilled in receiving information. They're either the public or they're public officials or even emergency managers. And Ken can tell you stories. We could go on forever about stories of people that you would think would be able to digest the information and analyze the threat, but they have an inability to do that. Some of the most profound, most recently, were the New York City Office of Emergency Management and Hurricane Sandy. Is they had more than sufficient information to understand that the threat to their city was substantial and the highest that it had been in memory, but they did not react to that information and made decisions based on a faulty line of thinking and a little bit of politics involved and a little bit of hangover from Hurricane Irene the year before involved, and it was very complicated in spite of the fact that that's one of the most sophisticated, if not the most sophisticated, municipal emergency management agency we have in the United States, and some of the best people we have in the United States. But they could not come to the right conclusion. Anyway, it's a in my mind, a monstrous public safety problem in the U.S. and different here, because we're talking about people with expertise talking to reporters that generally have some kind of expertise and understand it a little better. But I think it that problem may well infect all aspects of communication from government, that through the media to the public to journalists, as social media and the ability for anybody to have an opinion, informed or not, to distribute it, can confuse, and the general degradation of trust in government and trust in authority, that affects the ability to get an accurate line of information out to the public and to the world at large. So I wanted really Ken to tell a little bit of his war stories, and I don't know if you are finding this at all of you're having to debunk in your world, debunk information. You mentioned that in the West example there was misinformation out there, but are you finding it to become more and more of a challenge over time to deal with uninformed opinions and erroneous information that floods the marketplace of ideas?
And I'd add as a PS to that, what tips would you give to us as we try to figure out who's legitimate and who's not?
It just changed on me really quick. Yeah, it just changed real quick. So anyway, good. No, I mean, just a couple comments related to what we were talking before. I think, the first person on the scene is going to be the general public with the smartphone taking video and pictures, tweeting it out most of the time, right? I mean, you're probably not going to be on scene. I mean, if you happen to be at the Sonic, then you got a good story and you can start taking the pictures. But it's probably going to be somebody traveling. It's probably going to be somebody. And usually those photos don't come with just a picture, hey, look at this. This is unusual. There's probably some sort of opinionated comment. And let me start over again. Ken Graham, National Weather Service, and I'll continue. I caught it. Ooh, the glare just got me to the laser beams. So I think you're going to get those comments. And I referenced, and that's going to be their opinion, by the way. That's absolutely going to be their opinion. So if I reference back to Hurricane Isaac and the information that was coming out here, everybody picks up at these tweets. So no matter what we say, the dam broke has just gone viral before we even confirmed it. And I have, think about this. You have the meteorologist back at the office. And Brian, even the Weather Channel, you're trying to get information out. Everybody's high-strung. Everybody's got the trigger right there. Does that make sense? So when you first get that tweet, the dam broke, I can see the shaking of the hand. They want to put out the flood warning so bad, saying it's a dam break, and they want to put out an EAS message. You have to trust but verify, because it wasn't true. And it's already viral. I can see it on the screens. It's already scrolling, all that kind of thing. So it's a very difficult thing. So have those expertise on the Rolodex. That's funny that I said Rolodex. So have it in your smartphone so you can instantly be able to jump in there and get to the experts. Know the emergency managers. Know who they are. Get to the experts really quick so you can, at least have some really good information that is able to come out of there. There was a couple other points with that. Oh, the one last thing I wanted to say is I think the Weather Service with an entire NOAA, we all have this Weather Ready Nation initiative. And I think what we're really trying to do, if you break down everything down, we're trying to get to the impacts. We're getting better and better with the science. The models are getting really pretty decent. Hurricanes, if you look 24 hours out, we're 50 miles off, approximately 48 miles off. That's not bad. If you look at 48 hours, we're about 100 miles off. That's not bad. And we have intensity issues that we're working on. But it's the impact. And here's an example. What does 40% chance of rain here in New Orleans mean in the summertime? Nothing. A lot of science went into that 40%. But the reality is, it's Louisiana. You're supposed to have, you get a morning rain, you get an afternoon. It rains here in the summer. But if I tell Louisiana State Police, and believe me, we've sat in meetings like this with Louisiana State Police, if I tell them that the key time for that rain is between 4 o'clock and 6 o'clock on I-12 between Baton Rouge and Slidell, what does that mean? That almost equates to 100%, and you've driven that many times, that equals 100% chance of accidents. Does that make sense? So it's paring down to these, using science in a better way to pare down for more accuracy in a temporal fashion, but it's also being able to say, okay, state police, they will actually, if we can do that, they actually gear up overtime. They'll actually bend their schedules to make sure they have extra troopers during that period of time. Did I do? And that's it's Weather Ready Nation. It's the general public, but it's also officials to be out there responding to this in a different way. So the impacts is a huge thing we're trying to get a hold of.
This is Mark Sullivan with Entergy. When I worked for Constellation Energy, talking about stories, Brian, in Baltimore, based in Baltimore, and this fisherman was fishing with his family there close to our Calvert Cliffs location. His boat broke down, and he made the mistake of leaving his family in the boat and swimming to the shore and climbing the fence. So when he climbed that fence, somehow in the next 10 minutes, there was a tweet out there that Calvert Cliffs had a terrorist climbing the fence. And in a matter of 15 to 20 minutes, we had tweets all over the world that Constellation's Calvert Cliffs site had a terrorist climbing the fence. Well, the guy got to about the fourth rung of the fence, and he heard the click, and he had four M16s on him because he had climbed the fence of a nuclear power plant. So my point there is that blew up into a huge story. Was Baltimore media was all over it. But the lesson I learned there, and maybe something you can do too, we talked about building relationships early. That Baltimore reporter called me right away and said, what's going on at Calvert Cliffs? And we were able to give them the facts, what was going on. We didn't use the poor man's name that will never, ever go fishing again, or climb a fence, by the way. But that relationship building before you have anything, it sounds so basic, but in my business, our businesses, build relationships with those communications people, those business leaders in your own communities. So when you do have something that, which it could have been, but you have something that sounds silly now, that particular time it wasn't silly, you can get the facts very quickly. So build those relationships ahead of time.
So Nancy again. And following up on what you just said, Mark, in building those relationships, you know, work to build relationships. This is an obvious thing. I think probably all know this with all sides, right? Reach out to the nuclear plant. Do that tour so that you are on a conversational basis with all others. I'm going to pass it over here to Bill. Go ahead. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, this is Mark McIntyre at EPA. I just wanted to mention, too, running along that same line you were talking about, one of the most blood-curdling things happened to me, I mentioned it to David as we walked in my career of both public and private service PR, when I had an Associated Press writer not long ago say to me, I would rather be first than right. And that's the thing that kills us, is that everybody's in that same place. All across the psychographic spectrum, you have people who have incredible platforms through Twitter, through blogs, through Facebook pages, you name it, and that you have no idea of who they are or what kind of background they have. And that's the stuff that drives the news like every day. So it's a challenge for everybody, I think.
And this, David, I would just mention too that, you know, a lot of this, what I'll call noise, that is now public-facing, you know, we as an agency have dealt with on the inside-facing for a long time. So we get a lot of miscellaneous complaints and information, and some pan out, others don't. And I think our struggle for it is that pause to verify it. And it's tough. I don't know where that clock works and not works. I like this idea that we all have relationships so that when we're talking with each other, we're respectful and saying, you know, you want to give me just another hour. You need me to make just two more calls. The other thing in thinking about these networks, and I see Smitty in the back room and others, is, you know, we verify. We are not everywhere. And so many times we reach out to people like Wilma, or we reach out to people in communities that are much closer to incidents, even ourselves, as we're hearing things. As an agency, we reach into our community contacts, our police departments, our LAPCs, to ask them kind of firsthand what's going on the ground too. So we have we verify also, and I like to think that we get it right more of the times, because I'm trying to think of any time that we've sent a team where they got there and there was nothing for them to do. I don't think that's happened much, maybe never, but we certainly try not to deploy to do that. And so, but it does take that. It takes that willingness and that time and energy to do it, and really the relationship that everyone's trying to figure it out and to get it right.
I'm going to take just a minute. I think Mark has just a few minutes with us. Mark, if there's a nuclear incident we don't need to describe one. Can you outline just briefly the kinds of responsibilities that are occurring in the war room, what the state might be doing, what the NRC might be doing, what the utility might be doing? And even though we reporters might not talk to those people, who has different responsibilities for different things? Does that make sense?
Yes. Pretty complicated, but my teammates here can help me here. So if when you have any kind of incident and you have everyone at the JIC, everyone has a role. There's kind of behind the scenes roles, and then you have kind of the public facing roles. And back what we were talking about this morning is very important in our world, is making sure we have spokespeople that are trained and they speak the key messages that everyone can understand, including us. Everyone can understand. So one of the key roles that we're working with when we have an incident like that is making sure we have the right people, the scientists, so to speak, and then also the CEO or the business leader or whatever, making sure he or she is ready in a moment's notice to communicate, not every hour, not every 2 hours, but every 5 to 10 minutes about what's going on. So the big thing that we're focused on is making sure that we're communicating to the public and to our employees very quickly and giving regular updates. You know, just 5 years ago, you would give an update, I don't know, every hour, every 2 hours. Now, everything's changing so quickly, and then you add in social media, the expectations is updates every 5, 10, 15 minutes. And I know you see this all the time. So it is the other point I wanted to make is so basic, just around the partnerships, is that it takes, and I agree with you, there's a lot of infighting and a lot of disagreement and everything behind the scenes. But then when you go out to that public eye, it is one voice. And so everybody has a role. Everybody's trying to work together for the common good. But a lot of it's just making it happen as we go along. So that's what we do. We have a well-processed, well-trained. We learn a lot from every drill. And that's a huge part of what we do, too. All of our drills are not flawless. We learn something every time we should do differently. So that's how I'd answer the question.
So I have a follow-up for Mark Sullivan,
yes,
if you don't mind, because I know your time is limited. Sorry? Follow-up for Mark Sullivan. I'm Bill Kovarik with Unity College. Thank you. And it has to do with a specific problem that you must have faced during Sandy with the Indian Point power plant, which I understand is very not only one of the older units in the fleet, I think, but also has an evacuation plan that is a 20-mile radius, whereas other plants have a 50-mile recommended radius. So there's questions about how well an emergency could be dealt with at Indian Point. And how did things work in Sandy relative to that? So I'm sort of, this is a little bit more specific of a question, but it's the same sort of question. What happens in a command center, and then in a JIC, and then what was happening during Sandy? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I'll try. I wasn't with the company during Sandy. And maybe you can help me there too. Indian Point is one of those, it's a very important facility for our company. It is well run, it's financially viable, all those kind of things. So Indian Point is a facility that's going to be there. It's one that Entergy and the industry stands behind. And so you won't see any change there. Very close to New York City. Tremendous challenges, without question. Tremendous challenges if you were to have something Indian Point around the evacuation. And there is no answer. I mean, there is no one that's come up with any viable answer from any level that I've seen on how that would be done safely, efficiently, reliably, and quickly. That's just too many people to the highways, and all those things won't face that. So we've got a huge issue there, not just an Entergy issue. It is a industry, region, community issue on what happens if something happens at Indian Point. So that's something that, I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question. It's something that we've got our best minds, not Entergy, but the entire region of the country trying to figure out what the answer is. I mean, there is no answer that I've seen from any government lead, mayors, governors, on how that would happen. The message is we're not just throwing it to the side. We're trying to put our best thinking around what would happen if, and how would we do it? How would we get out people? You know, during Sandy, I know we sequestered our hire most of our employees there at the plant to make sure that the site's going to operate safely. But getting our employees, 2,000 people, is much different than trying to get, you know, millions of people evacuated. There's several plants in this country, not just in Indian Point, but Indian Point seems to be the biggest that has this challenge. But it is, it's something that we wrestle with all the time. Anybody add anything to that? I'm not sure I wasn't with the company with Sandy, but anything to add from your vantage point?
Ann Becker with Entergy. I would just say that we drill there like we do at our other plants, so it's a constant focus. If anybody wanted to have more information about that, we could put you in touch directly with our communications team at the plant who could give additional information around that specific topic.
I've got one additional reporter's tip on that, not on Indian Point, but Randy Loftus of the Dallas Morning News. Part of the disaster prep for journalists is probably getting familiar with the ADAMS system of documents on the NRC website. Now we're talking about Nuclear Regulatory Commission, not National Response Center. The NRC puts lots and lots and lots of documents online about every plant in the country, and although certain information is not put on there, safeguards, security, et cetera. But pretty much anything from a reporter's standpoint that you'd like to know to familiarize yourself with a plant in your community when things are going well, is probably available there on ADAMS.
And then this is Nancy. I have a question for Randy. Your paper did a workaround with West Texas. You got your own experts. Can you talk a little bit about that and share your experience, and when you can't get the information that you need from the official sources, what can we journalists do as a workaround? And how did your company find, how did your paper find the right company or the right experts to use?
Sure. Thank you, Nancy. One of the things that we realized early on is that a lot of the officials who you would assume would have intimate knowledge of a situation like this really didn't have a lot of knowledge about it. Some years ago, the Chemical Safety Board recommended that the EPA place reactives such as ammonium nitrate on the list of chemicals that require reporting through a risk management plan. The EPA did not do so, and headquarters has never quite explained why that happened. My FOIA on that question brought back a single letter they sent to somebody in Congress years ago saying, now we're not going to do that, but didn't explain it at all. So knowing that, and since it's not a reportable chemical, there wasn't a lot of data on this, except that what we knew was there was a long history, in fact, of ammonium nitrate explosions. It's the most widely used explosive on Earth, as a matter of fact, in bomb grade formulations. Miners use it all the time. Highway builders use it all the time to blast through things. There have been a number of just horrible accidents. There was a freighter exploded in Texas City, Texas, in 1946-8. Something like that. Killed 600 people. There have been other incidents as well. The bombing in Oklahoma City was done with ammonium nitrate fertilizer and fuel oil packed into 55-gallon drums and put in the back of a rental truck. So we know the stuff's explosive. The state had failed to make that point clear. A couple of 3 years before West, there had been a... I'm getting to the point of the question real quickly. A couple of years before West, there had been a fire at an ammonium nitrate facility in Bryan, Texas. The fire department there, instead of trying to fight the fire, evacuated basically the entire town. It's a large city. It's where Texas A&M University is. They did the right thing. What the fire marshal for the state did not do after that is send a little email or a letter to everybody else in the state who might have ammonium nitrate in their communities to say, by the way, here's what happened in Bryan. If you have a fire in one of these things, don't try to fight it. Get everybody out really quick. That would have been a simple thing to do. Knowing all that, and we already knew all of this, knowing all of that gave us a much more, a higher level of confidence that we could actually expose the information on this and not just receive it from official sources, because a lot of the officials had never made these connections before. So the most important thing for us was having some kind of institutional memory of what has happened in Texas and elsewhere in the past. Having been in Oklahoma City after the explosion, I can tell you that that lesson was certainly at the forefront of my mind. You cannot prepare for every single chemical to explode. There's hundreds of thousands of chemicals. You can't know them all. But there are some fundamentals. You're more likely to find ammonium nitrate in a farming community than you are any of the other hundreds of thousands of chemicals. That's a fundamental bit of knowledge you can bring to it. And you can apply that to whatever is appropriate for your own community. The important thing was having a base of institutional memory and being able to call out misstatements, even by high-ranking officials, when they were made, and not simply wait around and call an expert later. That's important because it adds to public credibility. If we have someone saying something here and then later I call an expert and get that expert to comment on that, that's not as effective as telling the person making the statement, you know, that's not correct. So it's really important. You have to put yourself in the position, not being a decision maker, but you have to be part of the mix of the public involvement on this. You really cannot wait around and be passive on these things. The second thing is we had a company that was, despite all of our, we've had as many cuts as anybody, but our publisher and the board of directors made a firm commitment to cover this like a local story, as if it had happened in Dallas. In fact, it's about 80 miles from Dallas. But we staffed it with a lot of people, a lot of photographers. I stayed in Dallas to do more policy-type stories, but we had a lot of folks on the ground. We followed it up for the entire year. We probably ran, I think the final count was about 500 stories over the course of a year. So that institutional commitment is important. If you're a freelancer, you're not going to have that, but you're going to have a small slice of that. And so sticking to it and developing that kind of expertise where you can wave your hand and say, wait a minute, that's not right, was supremely important.
Yeah. That picture on the screen reminds me of a different question that I'd like to raise. Oh, I'm Jim Schwab, with the manager of the Hazards Planning Research Center at the American Planning Association, also co-editor of a publication called Zoning Practice, which is exactly where I'm going with the question. I understand that often, you know, the media has had lots of cuts, and so it gets harder to get down in the fine grains of reporting things and to track some of the larger picture issues, long-term issues, that this picture represents. But one of the lessons I would hope comes out of this, in addition to all the emergency response issues and questions of tracking chemicals, et cetera, is there are a lot of jurisdictions where that location of that apartment, the location of that nursing home, the location of that elementary school would never have been allowed to happen because that plant was there first, that stuff came later, and there was no need to put it anywhere near, you know, in such proximity to a facility that had that kind of explosive potential. So the issue from a news perspective is not just the event itself, it's also the event when somebody approved this development well before the event ever occurred, and what kinds of processes were in place to ask the right questions about how that got to be in that location in such danger relative to that facility. And I think that's a question a lot of us have to answer, and a question that's always on my mind because I have that other background in urban planning, and I look at this stuff and I go, holy crap, who in the bright mind thought that that was appropriate? So I'd like to hear some discussion about that as sort of the more long-term news media coverage issue related to the potential for these events and setting up these situations in the first place.
So this is David Gray. I think I would start with saying that exists a lot more than you think. You know, I look to organizations like Wilma and to Smitty and to others who represent fence line communities all over the place that are at the edge of large industrial facilities that are home to people. And you know, I know folks that know at the agency, we're very interested in those communities and that interface, and we struggle with it nationally, you know, historically as a nation, and we struggle with it as we think about kind of urban expansion in the future. But we see it, I guess for us, we see it every day. We interface with those individuals every day through organizations that bring those issues to our perspective. And I don't know that there's any great model or design or plan that anyone would think is very satisfying. I know that in the individual locations, there's been, what some would identify as limited success. But today, there's just far too many people that have their home and their livelihood associated with close proximity to places that none of us personally would want to find ourselves.
And I'm going to interrupt and kind of exercise whatever authority I have and say that's such a huge societal issue. I mean, it's floodplains, it's earthquake zones, it's coastal regions that we'll move right along. What I'd like to do is kind of do a little bit of an extended wrap-up with your help. Going back to those, I think, five questions that one of you all listed up there, when something happens, what was it? What can go wrong? Where can it go wrong? And that kind of thing. Would you all be able to just kind of summarize for our participants again, how do they find out if something happens at a site, what kind of contaminant it might be? How, again, do they find out how that might behave in the environment? And I think, Bill, I'd like you to jump in at some point because you talked about the different types of contaminants and how they behave differently in the environment. And if you could also, at that point, when you speak, walk our people through what the names are of the types of contaminants, the categories in terms of volatility, floating along the ground, that kind of thing. So am I making any sense, Charlie? If you could talk a little bit about where do I go to get information on chemicals, and Ken, I want you to talk about where do I go to get information on wind and that kind of stuff.
Well, I think the first part of it would be, say it's a train derailment or a facility. Where's that information coming from? Well, sometimes it's difficult, and actually that's where a lot of accidents happen, where people are injured on response because they either don't know something's there, are not aware of it, and so they don't respond properly. So it's a real concern trying to figure it out. As a first responder, and I'm not a first responder, I'm used to what they call a tertiary, a third level, when they bring the scientist out, but the first level responder would be the people in the facility or the railroad people, the first people to come in contact. It could be a county sheriff. They often don't know. And what the training that's given to first responders is to look for information, look for placarding information that may have numbers on it, look for information. If it's on a facility, hazardous materials are placarded in some way or have some type of name or diamond or something to give some information as far as what that material might be. So they need to gather that information and start to report it out. But it's not uncommon, like even on the example here in West, that early on, just trying to figure out what happened is the biggest question. And it's an unknown. And, you know, hopefully someone resolves that quickly, because depending on the type of chemical, you know, that's when you get into, you know, where is it going to go and could it hurt? Because those are what you have to make a determination. You need to evacuate. You know, how can I put people in harm's way? But you've got to start out knowing with what the threat is. Because if we take from the perspective that it's an unknown, then we're going to respond from what's considered more of a minimum regret perspective. And it's going to be people going in level A suits, slowly trying to find the information. You're going to probably want to encourage that they evacuate people out away from the area. You're just going to, you know, assume for the worst. There's a lot of cost involved in doing that, and a lot of risk to the public in evacuating. This, if they had an early situation here and they thought it might be something, and they started evacuating that nursing home, there's risk to the people in the nursing home if they made the wrong call. So it gets real complicated. So knowing it is the real first hard answer. I bet you didn't answer as well as you like, but the reality is until someone gets a hard, and sometimes they get the answer wrong, and it's a different chemical. And that becomes even a bigger problem.
I think when it comes to the weather part of it, I guess our message to the emergency managers, and we do a lot of training with fire departments and that sort of thing, here's the message that I always give them. An observation is just a snapshot in time. So you can't confuse that observation. We talked about the monitoring versus the observations. We'll have observations first before some of the actual sampling. But if that observation is a snapshot in time, that is not a forecast. So I see mistakes by first responders, fire departments, so many times that they have an incident, they'll look for the nearest airport, and they'll take that observation, and they'll run with that through the whole event. And you can't do that. It's dangerous. It's very dangerous to do that. So I think it's the message I always give them is you have to spend time saying, okay, what's it going to be the next hour, in 2 hours, in 3 hours, when thunderstorms develop and start sending outflow boundaries, or here's the big one that gets people, the cold front will be here in 3 hours. You have an incident. And after the front passes, your winds are 180. Your first responders are on the wrong side, and they're going to get hurt, and they do. So the big message that I would just give this group is just what we really try to give the firefighters and the first responders is get the forecast. That's why I stressed today on the slides, we have that hourly out 7 days. The further you go out, of course, the least accuracy. However, it's something. So you can plan ahead if there's going to be an activity down the road, but if it already happens, get the forecast. Don't just get the snapshot.
So two things on the forecast. Could you explain what an outflow boundary is, how that the kinds of winds it generates and how that messes with your forecast? And then also, could you explain about in a convective area, is the forecast pretty darn good 3 days out, or is it just pretty darn good a day out? Can you explain that to me?
I think it's, from a meteorologist standpoint, it's generalized, so it's real good, because I'll say it's 40% chance of thunderstorms,
but
high temperature. Okay, I nailed the forecast. But at latitude, longitude, this, when a thunderstorm just bubbles up that morning, and you got a nice southerly flow, and then the outflow is just basically the cold air coming out of a thunderstorm, hitting the ground, and then shooting out. So you see these little lines on the radar? You ever see those outside of the thunderstorms? They shoot out from them. That's what I'm talking about. That's a wind shift line as well. So if you have an incident that's very sensitive to the winds, and that outflow comes from just a little thunderstorm, you got a wind shift. Depending on the situation, it could be more sensitive than other situations. That's the kind of detail that you can get from really getting that forecast, talking to somebody at the local office. And it's not just us. It's all throughout NOAA. It's all the Weather Service offices. We've got 122 of them across the country that are doing the same thing that we're trying to do. You can get that expertise from that. So even if the forecast is good, when you start drilling down to this building, that accuracy is not there in the general forecast unless something happened here, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And the other thing, that the National Weather Service office serving the stricken area will be very busy, but if you have a relationship with them, you might be able to go one or two weather services away and ask them just to explain on background what is going on with the weather there, or you might be able to get an AccuWeather or weather.com person to talk to you, because you do need that up-to-date information, and the people around the scene might be real busy, but there's someone in the outer ring who could also help.
And the great folks in the back, real quick, just the great folks in the back, they're great contacts too, because they're going to lead you to the office closest to you. So if you talk to them, they'll say, I know the right, they'll know the right people, they'll know the right area, they'll get you in contact with the right person with the expertise there.
And then the EPA, do you have anything that you want to mark?
So this is David. I guess I would add that, you know, the information gathering is really important. The situational awareness and understanding that it changes is also very informative. As part of the PowerPoint that you'll get, one of the things that is also a fact for us is that 80% of all of our responses are the same 14 chemicals. So we have a list of 14 chemicals, and of all of our history of response, they make up for 80%. So we have a small margin of unique chemicals that are involved in our accidents. And this is typical because most of these chemicals are under high pressure, developed under high pressure or high heat. So understanding the chemical nature of which the production side of a facility is very important to understand what its potential is. And so in this part of the country, which I said is about 33% of the accidents around the country, I would suggest that that list of chemicals that's on one of our slides is probably your priority list too. And so understanding those and understanding the nature of those, understanding how they behave, whether or not they are, you know, airborne, whether or not they sit low, whether or not they, how they move is not an impossible task. Because of the hundreds of thousands of chemicals that there are out there, there is this unique set of chemicals that, because of how they are produced, find themselves in a situation where they are typically involved in accidents.
That's great. Bill, did you have anything you wanted to add? We've got just a few minutes, and then Randy, I'll go to you, and then I'll finish.
Hi, Bill Kovarik here with Unity. This is a wonderful book, the Emergency Response Guidebook. This is my 1990 well-thumbed copy. Now I have it on my iPhone. So you can download the app for it. You can get any chemical number. Just highly recommended. It's in our links. It's in our handouts, also on the website. So that's what we were talking about. So when the first chemical spill happened in West Virginia, the methyl cyclohexane methanol, MCHM. Nobody wanted to say what it was or what the potential was for it, because nobody wanted to simply say, this is really cyclohexane. Because all you had to do is look up cyclohexane and you knew that it plumed and it was ground-hugging vapors and it was explosive and it was non-miscible in water, so that meant that it would go through the plumbing system and it could actually hurt people. So the idea of boiling the water, which was the first advice that people got, was really bad. And we had this debate over the SEJ email list, some of you might remember this, as to whether or not that kind of bad advice should be immediately countered by people in the press, or if they should wait and find experts. The press in West Virginia is not always timid. There's a couple of people who are extremely non-timid, to say the least. But they sort of waited for the experts. They didn't want to go out on a limb on that one. And I thought that was, you know, maybe they should have gone a little bit further out on a limb. So that was a debate that we were having. What should journalists do in that situation? The thing to do is to get familiar with these chemicals. And it's hard to do. It takes some studying. It might take taking a chemistry course or spending some time with this book. Okay, banning the book. Right. But it's worth it, okay? So that was my two cents. Thank you.
And I think we missed Mark. That was my bad. Did you?
He had to leave.
Okay. Do you have anything to add?
Okay. Thank you very much. This is Randy. I want to point out to you one of the early failings of my career, the premier for many, many failings. I was a young reporter at a small newspaper in South Carolina. It was a former textile town that was becoming a more diversified industrial place. And we had some friends that lived out in the country. We would drive out to see them. And to get there, we had to pass by the big fiberglass plant. And it always smelled a little sickly sweet. And I would just, I wonder what that is. Then I'd just keep driving. And it just never dawned on me, you know, I could ask. And so many years later, I realized I could have asked. Today, we have, for the first time in my memory, lots of crude oil trains going through Dallas. I never thought about it before. We see lots of coal trains going by, just going down to the from Wyoming to the plants in central Texas. But now we're seeing oil trains. So now it occurs to me, is there a particular danger here? So while following one of the tracks, I realized that one of the tracks that goes through downtown Dallas cuts literally under a corner of the Dallas Convention Center, where the second floor of the convention center makes a point and the rail line goes underneath the convention center. So now I'm thinking, I wonder if anybody's ever thought about that. So now I can do that story. So the point is, it took me a long time to develop my sense of alarm enough to realize that there's sometimes it's just laying there in front of you saying, we're in a kick me sign. You know, wearing a sign that says, please for the love of God, report on me. And it may be out there. So.
Thanks, Randy. So we're getting ready to wrap up. We're going to go to lunch. I just had a few. First of all, thank you all very much. I appreciate it. It was just really excellent. Few things on the JIC Center. A lot of this, some of this came out of 9/11, where they've really systematized response. And kind of what that means is there can be a bottleneck for information also, because it's all coming from one voice. And that fighting that they have behind this.
Not always fighting, but you just don't see it.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is, since they're speaking with a unified voice, you're hearing one perspective, and I'm not being critical of that, but one of the problems is the quality of that perspective is dependent upon the quality of the PIO, the public information officer. And it's not been uncommon for someone to be, especially on small local disasters, what they'll do is they'll get the county attorney in or somebody like that, but at any point, if that person's not clued in, you're not getting very good information, and then you go to the people who are in charge, and you still can't get information because they want you to go through the county attorney. So this formalized process that can work really well on a lot of scales is also a big obstacle for us. And so that's another reason that it can be harder than it used to be for us to get information, even from in situations of when it would have been easy before. The system has just made it too cumbersome in a way, but sometimes very good. The other thing that I think actually you brought up about, and it really is knowing who has responsibility, who has authority, and before somebody gets kicked. Just because the EPA is on site, our Corps of Engineers is doing something, or FEMA is involved, really doesn't mean that they have authority. And a couple of things that I've seen, just to use these as examples, is in the tornadoes down in Oklahoma and Missouri, I've seen national stories about how FEMA is not doing a good job on tornado shelters for schools, and they have conflicting standards that are confusing for superintendents and that kind of thing. Well, the reality is FEMA has no control over what a school district or a state does. Some of these things that the federal government gets knocked for really are local issues. It's decided by the local school board, you know, not FEMA. I don't want to sound like a whipping post, but this really is about how we can serve our readers. It's easy for people to beat up on the federal government because they're the biggest dog in town. But lots of times it is the local sheriff, it is the school board. And when it comes to planning and zoning, which was your point, Jim, it really is a local decision. And what happens is the locals don't want to spend the money, or they don't want to give up the tax base. Another example would be when we in Nebraska, we had our nuclear plant flooded in 2011. That was my hometown that you saw. You'd think that the NRC would be in charge. The NRC comes in, has a meeting with the utility and says, okay, guys, this is your problem. You're going to solve this. You know, so keeping in mind that where the line of responsibility in action occurs goes back to asking the right people the right questions. You'll get a faster answer. And one last example would be when we had that same flood, the Corps of Engineers ran the dams, but which flooded the communities down below, but they went through a hierarchy to the state emergency manager, who then was responsible to go to the county emergency manager. You might not like that hierarchy, but at some point your local emergency manager has a role in telling you whether you need to move out of the bottomland. So what I have found in the recent disasters that we have is that it does help to know, it really does help to know who has the authority and who's responsible. And also what I've noticed is it's as you all have talked about with this social media thing, everybody's on a learning curve and everybody's really changing as they go along, learning from the past experience. So the National Weather Service, for example, has webinars and briefings with emergency managers, with the media, and be in touch with your local weather service office if you're worried about blizzards, if you're worried about tornadoes, if you're worried about big storms, floods. You can get hooked into that system and be a part of it. You can go onto their website and get their latest briefing. The Corps of Engineers learned this lesson in the Missouri River Valley in the flood of 2011. They were behind the curve at the start, but by the end they were having weekly briefings that state legislators, federal legislators, the media all participated in. And so these agencies are learning as they go, and they're changing their procedures as they go. And it doesn't hurt to call the agency and say, it would help me if you did this. We did this during the flood of 2011. We said, can you archive your briefings? And they ended up doing it.
And something really handy is if you're not on NWS chat, get on it. It is behind the scenes. We can chat with the local media. Emergency managers are on there. In the heat of the battle, you get every single product the Weather Service issues, and you can chat back and forth. And if you don't want your neighbors to see it or don't want anybody else to see it, you can do private chats 24/7 with the meteorologist. Take advantage of that. You have information 24/7. And one last thing, watch terminology, because I go back to Hurricane Isaac. The way emergency managers and NOAA define the word imminent is it's going to happen. The definition of a different federal agency was it's going to happen if we don't do something about it. That's a big difference in the word imminent. So watch the terminology in the heat of the battle, because definitions, besides different agencies having different cultures, some of those terminology words are different. So watch those things. Make sure you get definitions of those words.
An NWS chat is something you need to call your local weather service office and get signed up if you want to do that. I think we're good. I'm sorry that we didn't get to all the questions, but we're ready for lunch, I think. Thank you guys very much. I appreciate it.